This Marketplace Morning Report special is supported by McDermott Will & Emery, forward-thinking legal advisors helping clients successfully navigate the CARES Act and other emerging legislation. More at mwe.com/cares.
Welcome to The Economy Reimagined, a Marketplace special report. In 2015, researchers working with the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston set out to measure the wealth of households. How's your savings? Do you own a house, a car, maybe some appraised jewelry? Subtract what people owe, and that's called net worth. For the typical Boston-area white household, it's $247,500, about $250,000. The median net worth of black households in the region, $8, eight, no zeros missing. This is about race and many other structural factors. I'm David Brancaccio, host of our Morning Report.
And I'm Marketplace's Kimberly Adams. Earlier this year, we commissioned a Marketplace Edison research poll to measure economic insecurity. As you might expect, given the pandemic, the economic anxiety index rose by the most we'd ever seen. But here's the thing. For people earning $25,000 a year or less, at that point, their financial anxiety hadn't gone up. It was flat compared to last year. Experts see this as evidence low-income people were already living with pandemic levels of economic insecurity well before the first case of COVID-19 showed up in the U.S. And folks earning $25,000 or less every year, that's a fifth of Americans.
It's also suffocating debt. No extra cash if car or body hits a bump. The costs of healthcare, childcare, education, and just who has access to the training and the connections to turn your good idea into a business. It's clear the system that provides our livelihoods, the economy, could do better for us and for the earth. That's what this program is all about.
Ideas to go beyond economic recovery and towards a system that works better for more people. This moment, the combination of the pandemic and the renewed energy of the social justice movement is prompting many to say now is the time to consider new ideas, policies and strategies that may have seemed unthinkable in the before times. We're going to explore some of these ideas with the help of a couple of families. We'll start with Francis Cox and Jason Perez. They're divorced and co-parenting their 17-year-old daughter, Nisa, in Chicago. Francis is 46.
I grew up on the west side of Chicago, the oldest of three children to a single mother. And I wasn't really sure about finances and like taking care of myself and those kinds of things as a young person.
Jason is 39 and was raised in a middle-class family on the north side of the city. His dad was a police officer and his mom was a hospital claims manager.
You know, my parents owned their house. And, you know, so I think there's always these moments where you think, oh, I should really be owning a house at this moment. Oh, I should really be doing this.
Growing up, Jason and Francis expected to follow a path that tracked the American dream. But life for so many families is much more complicated than that. Francis did well in school and after a $100,000 four-year education, now has a business cleaning houses.
Every day, I wonder to myself, do I dislike this job because I feel like it's demeaning? And that in itself is problematic to me. My grandmother cleaned toilets. There's nothing wrong with cleaning. And then I say to myself, you know, is it because I'm doing this manual labor? You know, is it because it's hard work?
Jason dropped out of school at 15 and fell into addiction, which led to prison. But he got out, got sober, and is now a researcher with a social justice advocacy organization. The Perez Cox family is among many who have experienced what happens when the economy doesn't quite work out, and they're helping us reimagine systems that could bring financial security to more people.
Kimberly, let's start our reimagining by turning to Andre M. Perry at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings, who works on ways to confront structural racism. Where would he start?
Wow, there's so many things from reparations to business ownership and business financing.
But if he had to start with one.
I'll go with if we can increase the number of black businesses that have more than one employee by 15%, we can expand the economy by $55 billion.
Frances Cox runs a one-person business. She's an independent contractor. And despite her reservations about the work, she likes the flexibility of cleaning houses.
I'm able to be home to help my daughter with her homework. I get to control my schedule. It's like I have my own business.
But if she ever wanted to expand that business, take on employees, for example, there are obstacles baked into the process.
Yeah, 4 years ago, the Center for Global Policy Solutions calculated that because of discrimination in lending, more than 1 million businesses that could have been never happened, nor did 9 million jobs or $300 billion in income. A Federal Reserve study, controlling for credit score, found that banks give a harder time to minority-owned businesses seeking loans. This year, amid the renewed energy of the social justice movement, some brand-name firms are stepping up to offer some of those loans themselves. Pepsi has pledged to lend $50 million over 5 years to black-owned businesses, responding to calls to, quote, hire or wire. Now, investment is the wire part. Here's Perry with the other one.
I'm from Pittsburgh, where Google landed its headquarters there. The black communities around that neighborhood are struggling. There has to be a deliberate effort to invest in black lives whenever a company comes to town. Remember, many of these companies could change the economic trajectories of communities with the snap of a finger by hiring them.
Perry is author of the book Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities.
There's another family helping us with this project, Rochelle Rittmaster and her brother Roland. He's 56, living in Houston, and struggling economically.
I mean, I don't know if I could ever make a decent living. So if I want to stay poverty level, I stay in my career. I've worked really hard in the field, and it's led me to a position to where I only see poverty.
That career is working as a massage therapist, which barely paid the bills even before the pandemic, when you could still touch people. Now the work has dried up, so one of his siblings, his sister Rochelle, is helping him out. She lives in Denver and is sending him $500 a month. Rochelle's had a successful career as an engineer, but she's quick to acknowledge that her own economic life could have played out very differently.
You just have to have luck, it seems. I can't say what that predictive path could be.
Even though she and Roland grew up in the same family in the same city, Kansas City, Missouri, they're about a decade apart in age. And Roland had a much tougher home life. Their father died when he was still really young, and their mother struggled with mental health issues.
It seems like a person's trajectory can turn on just about anything. Whether it is an accident or illness, whether it is a particular choice of path.
Or things individuals can't control, your race or ethnicity, or particular systems or policies baked into law.
An economy that doesn't treat people right can fuel anger. Political economist Mark Blythe at Brown University's Watson Institute distinguishes between corrosive anger that pits factions against each other versus the fuel for positive change.
A kind of righteous anger, a kind of moral anger that is a desire to be heard. And it's something you see in a lot of the populist uprisings of both left and right, this notion that we're not being listened to our elites and that they play by a different set of rules.
Blythe co-authored a new book with a hedge fund guy called Angrynomics that has a lot of reimagining in it. For instance, maybe big digital companies would pay people when they turn our data into gold. And Blythe is shopping the notion of the U.S. pulling a kind of Norway by creating a massive public endowment. Now, Norway's got North Sea oil profits for its sovereign wealth fund. What the U.S. has is super low interest rates that make government borrowing super cheap. He's among those who think rates will stay low from now on because inflation isn't just dead. Blythe thinks it's
dead.
Since borrowing at 0% is practically free, he suggests the government could go and buy tons of stocks, bonds, and other investments and let them grow on the markets. Call it a citizens' wealth fund, maybe like Harvard's huge endowment, but mega.
The The public owns the wealth, not in the way of some socialist notion, in a very capitalist notion that we are passive investors in the national fund for our wealth, and then basically we're able to distribute the earnings from that, not to the top, but more to the middle and the bottom.
Maybe a person could cash out of this to start a business when they turn 21 or help pay for college or something. Now, there are risks. A new world war would blow up the fund, but in that case, we'd have bigger problems, Blythe says. And some people, especially a subset of conservatives, worry inflation is not dead and buried, but could roar back, making the cost of servicing all the government debt a new burden on future generations. Staying on this theme of financial innovation, let's talk about what is called a social bond.
Investors are willing to raise funds, put money on the table for projects with a positive social outcome. And the real opportunity to provide an investment return to the investor as well.
Patrice Kunesh is the former director of the Center for Indian Country Development at the Minneapolis Fed and is now at the Native American Rights Fund.
Tribal governments do have the capacity to issue bonds, but I'd love to see a private-public partnerships where we could combine purpose with profit. And I think Indian country is a very attractive opportunity for investors, especially the opportunity to use lands for agriculture purposes, for energy development.
Kunesh, who's of Standing Rock Lakota descent, says tribal governments have to get the authority to determine how the outside investment would be used. But clean water, proper housing, and fast internet are places to start. Social bonds are in the news, with some big philanthropies borrowing to increase the grants those charities can give out during the pandemic. Those social bonds sold well. Another place where the horrors of COVID have inspired new thinking has to do with the $1,200 pandemic checks. Those look, taste, and smell very much like an anti-poverty system that's been under study for years, the universal basic income. This is where governments hand out money routinely, even when there's no emergency. Because for many, the emergency never ends, and further disruption is set to come when software and machines do more of our jobs.
And I'm afraid that, you know, through this pandemic, through this crisis, we just kind of sped up to our future.
Jose Quiñones founded Mission Asset Fund, which has devised a variety of innovations in the name of financial inclusion. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient.
I believe that there's dignity and purpose in work, and I believe that to my core. But I also think that there's dignity in helping each other out, and particularly when, you know, people are not able to work for no fault of their own.
Beyond COVID, Quiñones is among the many, including Tesla CEO Elon Musk, who support a universal basic income to create a financial floor for people amid rapid technological change.
This Marketplace Morning Report special is supported by McDermott Will & Emery, an international law firm helping clients understand options and seize opportunities as they navigate today's complex business restructuring landscape. More at mwe.com/restructuring.